So good morning, everybody. And well, I am very glad I will have yet another opportunity to talk to you about the theme will still be open loop quantum control. But this time, unlike in the tutorial, I would like to share with you where some of my current research interests in this area are, and show you some of the research that we have been doing recently, some open questions, and see how it goes. In particular, I will build, of course, on dynamical decoupling, as we heard not only from the tutorial, but many, many people here, including the experimental NMR community, where all these ideas were born from the physical point of view. I will build on that and try to cast it from a quantum information point of view within a broader frame that I like to think of, dynamical QEC, dynamical quantum error correction. And in particular, although this will not be the only thing I will tell you about, but I would like to put the most emphasis on these talks on showing how to use these ideas of decoupling interaction, of removing actively interaction that we don't want to have, and by interaction I particularly mean quantum decoherence in systems, to not only achieve ideally or practically in some systems decoherence protected storage of quantum information, of quantum states, but also decoherence protected, I'd like to say decoherence free quantum gates. So, you know, in the very early days, Roman people liked to have a motto that repetita iuvant. So I thought that in the first slides, I will repeat a little bit things that have been emphasized by many people through this program. And also, you will see some specific things that are the same as I had in the tutorial, in the hope that we can connect quickly and further understand what's going on. So the broad motivation, as I said, from a quantum information science point of view, is that scalable implementation of quantum information are only possible if we manage, because realistic devices are unavoidably noisy, if we manage to do them fault tolerantly. And quantum fault tolerance is a big research area these days, but in a nutshell, what this boils down to is the fact that every real world physical information processing device is both imperfectly isolated in the presence of the surrounding environments, and this introduces all types of quantum errors which can appear in the form of decoherence, dissipation, leakage, and all of that. And in the moment we try to actively come in and do something to counteract, to recover from those unwanted effects, clearly we don't have perfect control capabilities. Therefore, we are also ourselves introducing errors, and the game, or the holy grail of quantum fault tolerance, is in an essence trying to remove more error than the one we are unavoidably introducing in manipulating information itself. Now, that this is possible in principle was one of the main conceptual achievements of the early day quantum information science. It goes under the name of accuracy threshold theorem, or theorems, because there are many versions which have proved partly independent by different research groups under different error assumptions. And I won't go into technical details on that, but the one also to establish language on something that I will need, the one notion that I will borrow from this is the fact that in principle we have come up with fault tolerant architectures which can in principle support arbitrarily accurate quantum computation with an arbitrarily large size, so an arbitrarily large number of qubits, if we think obviously in terms of qubit realization, provided that the initial error level, which I'm going to kind of loosely quantify in terms of an error probability per gate, is sufficiently small. Now, this gives rise to a threshold value, and the way in these theorems differ from one another is precisely in the way that the error assumptions have been formulated and used to come up with actual numbers for this threshold. The original ones were pretty tight, very pessimistic. The more recent one, also including post-electric quantum computation, they are much more forgiving. And in fact, this number, if you look from an experimental point of view, for some devices, they're not too far as they are from actual figure of merits, 1%, that are achievable or very near to be achieved in current devices. But that's not quite enough, because the problem is now how to achieve the full-fledged fault tolerance. And this diagram here is meant to evoke one scheme, which is based on concatenated error-correcting codes. It's a very complicated way to embed recursively error-correcting codes into one another. I would like to say it's not the only pathway to fault tolerance. There are, for instance, topological approaches which work in a different way. But let me, for the sake of this talk, what I want to stress is that no matter which path to fault tolerance you think you'd like to implement, it is imperative that you start with an error probability per gate. And by gate, I also include storage here, which is the possibility to just store an arbitrary quantum system for as long time as is needed, that is sufficiently low. I was kind of playing with one of the architecture which is capable to support the highest error per gate was proposed by Manning Neal, is the so-called C4, C6 architecture. And without going into detail, but just to get some numbers because I was curious, it is possible following the specifics of that particular architecture to see that, for instance, if you start with an operating physical error per gate on the order of 1%, and then say that you want to have like a computation of size order of 1,000 gates on 100 qubits, well, following that particular architecture, another very good one is due to Andrew Steen, but you come up with effectively order of 10 to the 14 operations that have to be effected at the physical level. This is what we call in information science the overhead. So it's not the fact that it is in principle impossible to go arbitrarily accurate on arbitrarily large quantum information processor, but when you look at this from a practical implementation point of view, what is equally important is to have an idea what the overheads in terms of memory resources and gating resources are. These overheads are depending quite sensitively upon the specifics of the fault-tolerant architecture that you choose. However, the common feature is that if you start with smaller primitive error per gates in the beginning, they drop quite significantly. So for instance, in this C4, C6 architecture I was mentioning, dropping from 1% to parting 1,000 can get this number down. I don't remember if it is like 7 orders of magnitude or so, because they are very, very nonlinear behaving with respect to the scheme. So the only takeaway message from this is that we have to come up with ways for achieving smaller error per gates at the physical level in order to be able to reduce the overheads which are associated with this kind of schemes. Now, of course, there have been different approaches that have been considered, that are being considered by people. The one approach that I am focusing my attention on, at least in this talk, is open loop control. And this is one of the slides that overlaps with the tutorial I have given a couple of days ago. So just to say that in this context, what I see as being advantageous from in comparison, for instance, with closed-loop feedback or error correction strategies, is the fact that in open-loop error mitigation schemes, such as dynamical decoupling, we do not invoke measurements. And in principle, we also do not require auxiliary qubit levels. So these are, from a control point of view, less resource-intensive than quantum error-correcting codes. Of course, if they need a time scales, there is no free lunch, if they need a time scales, will be able to be achieved. And also, there are two other points in favor, namely the fact that we can borrow a lot from the expertise that the NMR community can give us. And what one can see is that these capabilities of faster and faster open loop control are becoming increasingly available in some of the current quantum information technologies, as witnessed by the fact that just over the last 1 or 2 years, there have been a lot of experimental validation of different decoupling schemes beyond NMR, just aimed at benchmarking performance of different decoupling schemes for quantum error for qubit stabilization. So remember that physically, the basic idea we are building upon is the one on coherent averaging out, taking away, switching off, effectively some interaction that we don't want to have in our overall evolution. And I was mentioning different QIP tasks. The one that I'm going to be concerned with in this talk is specifically having an open system and removing or suppressing coupling between this quantum system and its own environment. So it's decoherence control. And I will start with decoherence control again. I want to show you something on urine storage, but then I will move on to showing how to achieve decoherence control while steering the system in a non-trivial way, that is performing a gate. Okay, that's another overlapping slide, and I don't need to spend much time on that. Is the dephasing spin boson model that I have recalled with the idea of bringing up the main feature, namely the fact that we have, in general, we are going to have a system, an environment which is quantum, so it has its own dynamical degrees of freedom, its own Hamiltonian, and then there is going to be a coupling. This is a particular type of coupling on a particular type of quantum system. The simplest one is just a single qubit. And the idea of these active error suppression strategies is to be able to intervene on the quantum system on time scales, which are shorter than the minimum correlation time of the environment, namely the memory. Yesterday, we also had that talk very much similar to this model. We also talked by Guy, if I am now remembering correctly in the first name. The physical ideas, and remember, it all has to do about properly creating interference, quantum interference pathways within the correlation time, within the memory time of the reservoir. Or we can think that in those timescales, the interaction between the system and the bath is essentially coherent. So we can come in with coherent control and try to, in the simplest case, time reverse it. In more complicated decoupling scheme, to average it out to zero over certain time scales. So another way that I like to view this, and to it was mentioned in several talks, is also to think in frequency domain of what these fast control trains do, is essentially to make sure to dress up the spectral components of the original open quantum system in such a way that they are upshifted in their supports in a region of frequencies where basically the environment, the spectrum, has no longer components. So in effect, you can also think of decoupling in the frequency domain, as I think we have seen many examples in Guy's talk yesterday. Okay, so this one was the very simplest example. And in the tutorial, I have also, though I haven't covered them in detail, but in the final part, I had collected a bunch of recent experimental demonstration for qubit storage. This is just one. Let me just tell you what this picture is. This is taken from a recent Nature paper by, this is a collaboration between John Martin, is at Oxford, and then is a Princeton team. These are the same people who also demonstrated earlier coherent bang-bang control on Fullerene qubits. But this particular picture here is showing how by appropriately incorporating suitable decoupling schemes, and this is a decoupling scheme which is just based on flipping repeatedly flipping the state of a nuclear spin. The system is a single crystal which has phosphorus in silicon. This is the phosphorus impurity. And what turns out is that the lifetime, the coherence lifetime of the electron spin state is limited by the T2 time, the coherence time of the nuclear spin to which the electron is coupled. So what they were able, and before doing any kind of control, this is the T0 to N, this is the T2 time, the coherent, the decoherence time before doing control of the nuclear spin environment, order of 65 milliseconds. And by implementing decoupling appropriately, as you see here, there is decay as a function of the storage time for the electron spin. This goes up to longer, significantly longer than a second. So that's just something that contributed to build a solid state quantum memory, at least. Yes.
You were describing the two different pictures, the one in the time domain and the one in the frequency domain.
Yes.
And you said that in the time domain, you can view it as interfering both ways. And so maybe I missed that. I don't remember in Guy's talk that he focused on interfering pathways. I remember mostly the frequency domain picture of.
He stressed a lot the frequency. He showed nicely, for instance, for different spectra of the quantum environment, which was a bosonic environment, same as here. But here you see I have not yet done the continuum limit. Here I have, this is an ohmic environment, just like he was having in one of the slides, with a soft cutoff. It's not like a theta function. And what he was showing is how different sequences, in particular this one, and then more sophisticated ones, are kind of trying to put the dressed frequency components beyond where the peaks are.
Right, but you're saying that has an equivalent interpretation in the time domain in terms of interfering pathways?
Well, I mean, the way in which this suppression operates is because you are essentially disrupting, by means of this fast operation, you are disrupting the coherence dynamics on a time scale which is shorter than the system bath correlation times. So what I'm trying to say is that if you act too fast, the reservoir correlation function will have evolved, and they would have unrecoverably moved away information in a way that it cannot be undone with this. So yes, I think it's like having an overall coherent evolution. We don't think usually of system bath as evolving coherently. But in these kind of time scales, it is as if they are just coupled quantum systems. And what we are doing with this control is to disrupt the coherence pattern that goes on in there.
But did I thought you said that you actually can view it, the mechanism, in terms of interfering pathways.
Well, interference in the sense that you interfere with the natural coherence dynamics is that this is a coherent disruption of.
Interference,
yes.
Not in the sense of quantum superposition.
Yes, correct.
But interference, yes. In the sense of, in the sense of quantum superposition, or in the sense of interfering, the way we use the word in English, through disrupt.
I think you can also look at it as quantum interference.
Yeah, I think so, because you really touch how the amplitudes, the quantum coherence evolves in these short time scales, and in the absence or in the presence of these kicks, he showed explicitly the off-diagonal density matrix. This is the same that I have. It is disrupted. So to the extent that you think of a quantum interference effect of changing the balance between the complex coefficients in front of pure states, for instance, that propagate, I would say that yes, this can be viewed in that way.
And has anyone tried to analyze it in those terms?
Yeah, actually, But before you do the Fourier transform, in my example, I didn't stress that, even you could touch it, but you can look at it as you take whatever the state of the system is now, and then it goes into the bath, and at a certain time in the future, it'll go back into the system.
Yes.
But you, and then you choose to change the system in a way to have destructive interference in the decay.
Yes, yes. And if you wait too long, the game is, well, or you can accelerate, you can do other tricks, you can change in a way that, so this is probably also the same, okay, we can discuss, but yes, I think it can, and I'm glad that, okay, but let's move a little bit further. This is also, again, just in the spirit of recall basic things that have been said and to reestablish the language that I'm going to use. So I am going to consider an open quantum system which is coupled to a semi-classical controller. So the basic elements here, that is going to be a target system Hamiltonian, which is going, for me, is going to be red. It's funny because yesterday somebody used exactly the opposite color code. Yeah. I think Burker, no, also he had the environment being red because it's uncontrollable, whereas for me the environment is green and the system is red. I don't know why. Anyhow, we have an open quantum system, so system identity on the bath, and the bath degrees of freedom, a general quantum mechanical coupling, unlike in the previous example. And what we are interested at is the reduced dynamics of the system once the degrees of freedom of the environment are going to be discarded at the end. And because in all of these dynamical error correction strategies, what constitute the environments is going to be, by definition, uncontrollable directly, so I cannot directly touch the degree of freedom of the environment, then the controller is going to be a join with an identity action on the environment, and I'm going to parameterize this in terms of control inputs, which, and control Hamiltonians, which specify the admissible set that can be turned on and on, presumably in a natural implementation. And these control inputs will be subject to different control constraints as we go along in the talk. So the first objective on which I will spend again a little bit of time is the one that we talked about already, but is essentially to try to achieve a time suspension, which is, first of all, to be able to ensure that we can correct. I am going to call error Hamiltonians whatever contribution I aim to effectively remove from my total evolution. So if I make reference to this total Hamiltonian here and my decoupling objective, for starters, this will change later, but for starters, we have to make sure that we are able to store, then I want to be able to both compensate unitary evolution, which is present in the internal Hamiltonian of the system, as well as compensate, that is suppress, or dynamically correct, that is going to be my general terminology, this system and this coupling operators here, which, remember, I have already called error generators. So the first benchmark that I want to be able to assure, to achieve, is an identity on the system, which means that for a finite propagation time of my choice, I will be able to ensure arbitrary state preservation. I have picked a pure state, but clearly it doesn't have to be, and that means essentially an error corrected memory. So first of all, let me go again in what has been repeatedly called the bang-bang setting, which means that I will, for now, allow myself the freedom to achieve unbounded controls, unbounded amplitudes, so infinite energies, not good for practical purposes, but it's a starting point. The big advantage from a modeling point of view is that under this approximation, you can clearly separate the action of the controller from the action of, or the natural evolution of the open quantum system, because since what I call the error Hamiltonian, the error generator of this, they have no time to act if the pulses are taking no time. It's clearly an approximation, but it's a starting point, and actually not so bad in some situation. Once again, I will stress one last time that what makes what constitutes the basic physical principle, what makes this method working, is essentially a timescale separation between the action of the controller, the timescale of the controller, and the minimum timescale, correlation timescale, which is present in the interaction that we are trying to actively suppress. So again, to contrast to, for instance, standard quantum error correction procedure, which it's not that they don't work in a non-Markovian error regime, but they work best in a usual Markovian probabilistic error model. These kind of techniques, instead, dynamical quantum error correction, they work best for slowly correlated non-Markovian error processes. And I also think that this was stressed a lot through the explicit, what we saw yesterday, a lot of memory kernel that were appearing throughout the derivation. So that is what I am also referring to, aside from the different meanings that this word Markovian, non-Markovian might mean. So I hope that the physics is clear behind it. Okay, so I said I want to talk about some of the challenges, at least from a theoretical perspective, that are interesting me and many other people, of course, here in decoupling theory. So one, there are three that I picked here, and I will tell you something about a couple of them. One is, well, simple decoupling schemes, such as what we call periodic decoupling, just repeating periodically a given control cycle time over and over. Well, they are very nice and easy theoretically, but they suffer many shortcomings. In particular, as you keep repeating the same control cycle, which in practice is going to be imperfect because you are going to have finite separation between consecutive pulses, even in the bang-bang limit, there is going to be a lot of error accumulation that goes on. Remember that I stressed the fact that in this low-level schemes, we are, in terms of an average Hamiltonian picture, suppressing the error revolution only to the first order or lowest order in terms of Magnus series or in terms of a Taylor expansion, if you prefer, of the total propagator. That's a starting point, but it's not enough if you want, for instance, to ensure that the storage, the memory time, is as long as you want to be. And unlike the case of gates, where it might be enough to do them and do them fast, then no op gate. So the storage you really need to be able to do it with as long time as required, because in an implementation you might have a lot of idle stages of computation, and you need to preserve that in the course of the algorithm. So that's one problem. And it has triggered a lot of high-level decoupling designs. Then I have, here comes another big challenge, and it was touched upon briefly yesterday. What about not just storing information, so freezing, suppressing evolution, what about actually thinking to perform gates and do a quantum computation or quantum information processing while we are also suppressing interactions? So is it possible to reconcile the possibility of suppressing the system-environment couplings by having these fast modulations or by having these strains of pulses in place, and then at the same time being able to steer the system so that some non-trivial operation can be performed? That's obviously the next ingredient that is necessary if we think to quantum information processing. Okay. Actually, from a purely abstract control theoretical perspective, this issue of combining decoherent suppression together with the ability of also imposing additional logical operation, that was looked at quite some time ago in the bang-bang limit, and it turns out that there are various schemes in principle for combining error suppression and decoupled evolutions, if you like to think about it. Well, you might think, for instance, too cleverly, since these pulses in the Bang Bang limit take no time, you have pulses and then you have free evolution periods, and perhaps you can manage to plug in, to intercalate cleverly some operations which are meant to be gating operations with the error suppression that the pulses do. Or maybe you can think to, while these trains of pulses are on, to again cleverly spreading the action of a gating Hamiltonian through several cycles. Why am I saying cleverly? Because in the moment you have these trains of pulses in place, you have both timing constraints, because you have to be careful when you do something else on the system not to screw up, not to spoil the averaging action that the trains of pulses do. So you have to either synchronize with the operation of the controller, and you have also have to be careful with the symmetry properties of the gating Hamiltonian that you apply, because if you have this decoupling in place, perhaps it might well average out the gating Hamiltonian that you are trying to achieve. So you have more constraints, clearly, in trying to control a decoupled evolution. Nevertheless, as I said, there are constructive recipes for doing that, and recently there have been kind of rigorous error estimates that have been derived on how well some of these early days schemes can work. What I don't like much about any of this is the fact that, well, the synchronization constraints that you end up having are quite stringent from a practical perspective. Sometimes, in order to be able, I said before that one advantage of these techniques is that they do not need auxiliary qubits, but if you want to do computations, sometimes you have to encode into a subspace. And all of these error-corrected schemes, nevertheless, what I'm referring here, they only work, they have been only considered in the instantaneous pulse limit, bang-bang limit. So I saw a question from Almut here. Yes?
You don't have all these constraints if you use dissipation to keep you in the subspace. Then you don't need to have any timing issues, you don't need to have any...
I have no subspace here yet. It's a full Hilbert space.
Sure, but if you want to keep... if you suppress your errors with dissipation, then you don't have...
Yes, but here I, of course, that's a big plus, but my for now comments to that, at this stage, this is purely unitary non-dissipative control, and secondly, what the goal here was is to ensure universality construction, not just being able to remove one particular type, but being, having recipes by which you can retain universal control. So, but I agree, absolutely, obviously. Yes, yes.
Have any of these schemes looked at the effect of breakdown of the two-level approximation, doing really hard pulses, you might couple with higher levels?
Well, actually, yes. And in particular, there is a work that comes to my mind by Lin Tiam and Seth, and they were, Lloyd, they were particularly interested at multi-level qubit systems as they arise in some superconducting implementations where the computational bases are two chosen levels, but then you unavoidably couple. And you might couple badly because these hard pulses are spectrally pretty non-selective. So you can go this way. I mean, whether you can address this problem depends a little bit on the specifics of the system. So in that case, they were able to kind of devise the sequence in such a way that it would also compensate for this leakage automatically. There is also work that has been done by Dan Leader and collaborators on going around the leakage problem, but I do not think I have a general answer for that. It depends a lot on the spectral content of the system, I think. But yes, from what I can say, in fact, and it connects with, in many situations, having delta pulses, when you want to have a spectral selectivity as impossible, so you'd like to be able to act in a more soft way on your system, taking some time, necessarily, not being instantaneous, in doing so. And indeed, that's the third question that I put down here. What about more realistic, for whatever reason, types of control pulses? And I know that here we have been hearing a lot about designing pulses with very, very sophisticated and powerful techniques. My aim here, and let me say this from the very beginning, because I will try to design gates pretty soon. My goal is not to beat at all the beautiful optimized profiles that can come up from methods such as optimal control or so. What I am interested here in the first place is to make sure that from a general control theory point of view, solutions can be proved to exist under certain assumptions, and then leave room for optimization to come in once the general procedures have been laid out. So I will have more to say on this later on in the talk. For now, let me comment on the fact that if you relax this assumption, which is unphysical, of being able to act in no time, so having delta pulses, having the same type of open loop engineering with bounded control amplitude, so where all the operations take a finite time to place, is significantly more challenging from a theory point of view, because you can no longer separate the controller and the evolution of the open system. Because, in other words, now you have to compensate for decoherence or whatever you want to remove, both in between the pulses, but also during the pulse themselves.
So just maybe I can ask you a question this way. Do you view what you're doing as a lower bound on what can be done, or as an upper bound on what can be done?
I view it as a rigorous proof of principle instruction. And I view it, if I might borrow something from what Burkhardt showed, it's better to anticipate that than going later. At some point when he showed his optimal control or grape design pulses for NMR for compensating certain types of errors, which I believe in those cases were primarily offsets, he said that he not only recovers all the classical composite pulse sequences that were in the earlier day of NMR designed by hand analytically based on symmetry consideration and such. He would recover all of those and more. So my hope with all of this is to come up with the analog of the classical type of things, which are analytically generated, and then leave room for optimization. And one important, for me, motivation for wanting to do that is because I would like to gain insight. When you have analytical construction, you don't aim at optimal. You can't get the best performance this way. But what you can often get is insight between on how different parameters, different, here for instance we have the system Hamiltonian, the bath Hamiltonian, the controller, how are these different factors going to interplay with one another? And this is kind of some insight that you can get once you have analytical things in place. So that's my goal, but I would hope that the solutions I'm coming up, they would be taken over by the people doing optimizations, and I would like all of the sequences to come up and get much better one in the end. Does it make sense?
So the way that you're describing now, it's a lower bound. You can do better if you do optimization.
Yeah, I am not aiming at optimization.
In other ways, it's an upper bound because you're allowing delta function pulses. If you do the optimization,
no. No, in the second, when I'm going to do gate design, I want to relax this. Otherwise, to do gate in delta pulses, you do it. It takes no time. There is no error evolution. So that said, these are the two, mostly this one. But since I didn't give any example in the tutorial, I want to tell you a little bit about some work that we have done on applying bang-bang decoupling to a realistic setting which is provided by the suppression of hyperfine decoherence in a semiconductor quantum dot. This was work done with one of my former postdocs, Wen Zhang, and Slava Dobrovitsky in Ames lab. And then, above all, I want to tell you about what I'm doing these days with Kaveh Kojaste on constructing dynamically corrected universal quantum gates with bounded control resources. So, okay. That's another overlapping slide. Just briefly, as I said, the simplest. So this part is bang bang, okay? We're going to go beyond that in a second. But this is still the same idea of having periodic. This is the low level schemes with periodic sequences of instantaneous pulses in place, whereby we have the cycle propagator, which is expressed in terms of the Magnus series, the average Hamiltonian, and we only look in lowest order to properly engineer the zeroth order Hamiltonian by means of these operations here. So what we want to make sure is that the choice of the decoupling group, namely the choice of the decoupling pulses for a given error model, is such that certain decoupling conditions are obeyed. That is, the action of this symmetrizing projector here on every error generator gives us zero. So that's a minimal condition to require in order to ensure that the unwanted contribution are filtered out. Now, this, as I mentioned, has several problems because you have a coherent error accumulation due to the correction that you are neglecting in low order design, and that is a worst case error bound on the fidelity for storage time t, delta t separation over pulse. And then remember, I'm always assuming that there is a the Hamiltonians I'm trying to remove, they are norm bounded. There is a finite strength, otherwise this wouldn't work. So some of the ideas that have been recently proposed to go beyond this low-level averaging is concatenated dynamical decoupling. This was proposed by Kaveh Kojaste and Leader a few years ago. And here the idea is to recursively apply lower order sequences like one inside the other in such a way that higher order in decoherence are also suppressed. I will give you an example for a single qubit setting. The general cases are far too complicated for us to look at. These schemes, which is due to Urich, was proposed more recently and was mentioned yesterday as well. This scheme is kind of neat because when we do concatenation, the number of pulses that are required to remove decoherence or error Hamiltonian up to a given order grows exponentially with the order of concatenation, whereas in this kind of scheme, we have sort of an optimal, although it's not optimal in the meaning of optimal control of anything like this. It's called optimal simply because in this model, which is the spin boson model, you can solve exactly the dynamics and you can enforce by hand that each and every order of decoherence is cancelled by analytically choosing the separation between pulses in this way. And what this scheme accomplishes, but this is pure dephasing, is that for a given storage time to cancel decoherence to a given order, you do not need exponentially many pulses, but just order of linear complexity. So there is this is a much more efficient scheme, except this efficiency is lost if you have a generic decoherence model. It only holds true for pure dephasing. And then there is another completely different strategy that I have tried to pursue, which is randomizing the operations of the controller with the intuition in mind that if we look at this formula here for how the fidelity decays, this is a this is just an order of magnitude. It decays over time as a function of the total duration. Well, there is a T-square behavior, and that T-square behavior arises physically because we have error amplitudes that add up coherently. Then we take the square. Fidelities are roughly error probabilities. We take the square, and here we go. So the idea of randomizing the operation of the controller, which means choosing whether to apply randomly certain operation, is to scramble probabilistic, to prevent these coherences, to build up in the deterministic way, and making sure that when we take the square and look at the fidelities, we don't get a T-square, but we get kind of a random walk behavior because we gain a square root from the T-square to T. Okay, well, the catch here is that in order to successfully use randomized sequences, you better track, keep track, record which sequence of operation you have applied, because eventually you will need to return the state of the system in the physical frame. Or otherwise, if you just apply without care a random operation, you will decohere the system more. Okay, I said let's go to a concrete example. I want to consider an electron which is sitting in a semiconductor quantum dot, and as you will see in the next slide, the kind of interaction involves X, Y, Z errors, and this is the Bath evolution. So this slide is meant to show you how, for this particular case of a single qubit coupled arbitrarily to a quantum Bath, the ideas of concatenation and randomization can be put to work. So first of all, the basic sequence, this we showed in the tutorial for removing an arbitrary interaction, is to do decoupling according to the full Pauli group. This means this basic cycle with two pi pulses in two orthogonal axes. So in this case, the error Hamiltonian is removed to the lowest order. That means that the first order correction still is there. So what all the high-level schemes trying to do is to improve with respect to this case. And you can improve in different ways. The simplest is if you just want to get rid of H1 and have errors which come in at the next level, just symmetrize your control path. So that means that you look at what I call the symmetric decoupling protocol, and if you can see, this is just this sequence, time mirrored. This is extremely well known to NMR people, and I don't need to say much more on that, but that's the sequence you get in this case. Then concatenation for this system would mean to recursively apply the Pauli decoupling group. So concatenation would carry an extra label here, or that M is the concatenation level. And at the level M plus 1, what you have here, we have four pulses in this decoupling group, I, X, Y, and Z, and that would be the basic concatenation level. In the next level, you embed, and therefore you have, level 1 pulse, level 1 pulse, level 2. It's probably better to look it directly in the example. So you see that the pulses are X, Z, X, Z. These are the pulses X, Z, X, Z in the low level. So how am I going to concatenate and get the second level? Well, this is the recipe. Take the pulse, but then embed here. So these are the original pulses. And instead of having a free evolution, you put in the whole previous level sequence, which is just that. And then you simplify using the properties of the Pauli matrices. So for instance, if you have four pulses at the lowest order, the next level would become 16, and so on and so forth. Okay. How do these things work, and what is the physics problem I was interested at? I don't know what these lines are. They are not supposed to be there. So yes. It's a super cycle, just in case. Yes.
A lot of super cycles used in NMR. Like, how does it correlate? Is that a known, already known super cycle that you apply there? Or, like, 16, XY16, whatever.
That is a good question.
I
have looked at that, and it's not the Levitt style. That I can say, because to my knowledge, the Levitt, at least the ones I looked at, he has many, is not designed to remove the three direction, so X, Y, and C. Because you don't need, because you have the strong quantization axis, and that kind of takes care of two of them. But I mean, this is, the idea clearly is the same. But this is an extension to where you have arbitrary direction in place, and you can analyze the convergence and see how it works. I think it's exactly, I like to say supercycle, because that's what it is. Anyhow, so that's a physical system I have considered. So it's a single electrospin as a system, and it's coupled with a bath, which consists of nuclear spin, for instance, spin 1/2, although it doesn't have to be the case, and it's not the case in real devices. And this interaction here is an hyperfine contact interaction, electron spin and nuclear spin, and these are strength for that. What we had in mind with this is gallium arsenide, for instance, quantum dots, which are operated at very small temperature, like sub-Kelvin, and they typically contain kind of mesoscopic numbers of nuclear spins, order of a million. So you can also do estimates by knowing the wave functions of the electrons of the total strength that you get for the hyperfine interaction. And this is actually a root mean square that comes out from that. And of course, as a consequence of the coupling between the electron and the nuclear spin bath, there is going to be decoherence that is going to be induced. So we have a T2 for the electron. Actually, to be more precise, in ensemble-based measurements, what experimentalists really extract is a T2 star, which is an inhomogeneously broadened value, which is on the order of 10 nanoseconds for distance. And the actual single spin decoherence time is is related to this by an inequality in this way. So the question we wanted to look, and these are devices that, that are considered by many people, one experimentalist even in my own university, Alex Rimberg group, this is implemented in double quantum dots, but also in Harvard, Charlie Marcus, and Jason Petta in Princeton. So can we use decoupling in the sense of a high level that I was mentioning before? Two questions that were two features that made this problem interesting to us is the fact that on the one hand, the nuclear spin bath is very well separated in timescales with respect to the electron. And very well separated means that the timescale for the nuclear spin evolution is kind of 10 to the 4 times lower than the evolution timescale for the electron. So it looks like the reservoir is almost static with respect to the evolution of the electron. So it's a non-dynamical reservoir and very slow, non-Markovian in the sense that I mentioned before. So naturally suited, let's say, for this kind of fast control techniques. What we wanted to also consider is the case where in a very small bias field, when these terms goes to zero, you have both longitudinal and transverse decoherence that can be compete on the same ground. So some questions are, well, I mean, how fast do you have to pass to accurately suppress the hyperfine interaction in the system? The theoretical estimates, if you look at the spectral cutoff that come in from the mesoscopic nuclear spin bath, they are, if n is this number of spins here, they apparently look to be extensive with the number of spins, so they get you huge numbers. So do you really have to go that fast? Or can you instead stay with the strength of what is called the Oberhauser field, so the inverse of these two T2 star, loosely speaking. And aside from timescales, out of this plethora of decoupling schemes that you can have, what are the best ones for this problem? So this we looked at by considering numerically exact simulations of the control dynamics for Schrödinger evolution in the presence of these instantaneous sequences of pulses. And I have two slides to show to you. This is where, as I said, we are focusing on the objective of being able to store an arbitrary unknown state of the electron spin. And in particular, we want to do so. We want to see if we can do so by using separation between pulses which are outside what the convergence radius of the Magnus expansion would give us, which is, so in other words, what we wanted to see is the theoretical estimates are pretty pessimistic. Do we really have to believe them in a real system, or can perhaps be more optimistic? And the delta t's here, remember, they are the basic separation between pulses in a periodic train. Then the concatenated shrinks those or extends, gets super cycle. So here are results. Time is in unit of, this got shift in one of the, over the strand, sorry, this should be moved here. And this is exact simulation for a bath of 15 spins. What you see here is what would happen. This is the free induction decay signal without any pulse in place. So this gives you, no matter, you can, for instance, look at the width of this at half height. What you see here is a minimum fidelity minimized over the initial state of the electron. So it's a worst case scenario. This is how you would lose it without doing any decoupling. And then you see a bunch of curves. Whose quality gets better and better in this direction. So I can just mention this is the periodic decoupling. That's just repeating the XZ kind of pulse suppression, and it recovers. But if the goal is to ensure arbitrary long storage time, it's not doing good enough. So that's what, just by symmetrizing, this is an XZ, XZ, ZX, and so on, repeated. This is as much as you gain. And these are the two best performances. In particular, this one is not constant. It goes down eventually, but is absolutely the best one in this case. And this is the supercycle, the second order concatenated. That means take that 16 pulses that I illustrated before, and repeat that over time. So it is still a periodic repetition, but you design better the supercycle inside. And if you do a Magnum series analysis, what you see, in fact, is that the order of suppression of the decoherence here is at least in, I don't remember, maybe I wrote it down before, is in fourth order or even more in the Magnus series. Probably here, yeah. The coupling, if we do this concatenation here, appears at the fourth order and higher. So that translates into longer and longer storage time that you can achieve with high fidelity. So for this system, this appears to be the best performers.
How do you think about the fact that you're outside of the Magnus convergence domain? You're just getting lucky that it works? When you're outside of the convergence?
Well, the convergence, and better say, the condition for properly truncating the series gives you, from the control point of view, a sufficient condition, strictly speaking. Whether this is also necessary, that depends on the specifics of the system and the spectral content of the environments that you have. In this case, this we did like a couple of years ago. Nowadays, I have also better ideas because this bath is not an arbitrary bath. It has a local structure. It is individual spin for the nuclei. Therefore, I'm pretty sure that even the theoretical estimate can be tightened up and made to work better. Yes?
But were you using pulse delays at greater than a nanosecond here, or on the bottom here you have delta 2.1?
Yes, because this, okay, yeah, this you have to, this is in unit, this 0.1 is in unit of 1 over A, which is the value of, yes.
But what were they in real time? were greater.
Yes, 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 right.
How much longer?
Can I do the conversion and get, yes, let me see if I remember this. What I can say is that this corresponds roughly, when I spoke to experimentalists, is still one order of magnitude away from what they can do in the lab. So that is not something that they can do today, but hopefully they can get there. And but I can get back, forgive me, I'm not fast on this conversion, but I will get that to you. Another application, which is kind of different, but I want to mention because I thought it was neat, is like, so far I have emphasized the use of decoupling for preserving a state which is unknown. That's not the only use you can consider. Suppose that instead you might preserve optimally a given electron spin state of your choice. Then there is, again, allow me to mention NMR once more, and let me tell you what could happen here. What you see here is a specific initial state of the electron, which is dependent upon which sequence. So here there are different sequences that are being used. And you can think of each sequence as creating an effective field that even though I have said that I have no magnetic field present in the electron, but by applying the pulses, you create an effective field by and large. And although the direction of that field depends on the sequence that you are applying, because the sequence is under your control, you can manage, once you have this effective field for the single spin, to align the initial state in that direction. And if you do so, it stays locked, and the evolution is kind of frozen. So this is exactly what this shows. It translates into the fact that for a long time, the fidelity of storage, not of an arbitrary state, but of that particular state that is aligned with the effective field of the sequence that you create, stabilizes indefinitely in time. So you have kind of a plateau in the coherence. Although this plateau would eventually disappear if you remember that this is a quasi-static bath. So the bath Hamiltonian, the bath is very slow. If it would become faster and faster, this plateau eventually would disappear. But for the case of the dot, I think Steve Lyon, now in Princeton, has been playing with these tricks and kind of locking the electron spin in different direction using these protocols, but I think that the results are not yet out available. So I just wanted to mention this and leave the storage part behind and get to what I really wanted to talk about in the first place, which is gates. Is there questions or any more question on before I leave the bang? I'm going to leave bang bang and I'm going to leave storage now for good. Okay, I don't see them. So what is the goal now? This is the same picture I was having before. And remember that I stressed that one big, for a poor theorist, advantage of bang bang pulses is that there is no time for error evolution to occur. Right. But if we consider real life pulses with finite duration, which is not negligible, clearly whatever error revolution you have will have time to act. And roughly speaking, the error per gate will be proportional to how long the gate will take times how strong the error components will be. So that is kind of a first order in the gating time and in the strength. So the question I want to attack now is, can I reduce, going back to my very first slide on fault tolerance, can I reduce the error per gate in a generic gate by avoiding the assumption of bang-bang pulses? Once again, many hints come from NMR, and I picked up two, but this list is not complete. I should probably also add the pattern pulses and the universal rotation pulses that were mentioned yesterday. But let me say what I was aiming at here. For instance, in NMR, composite pulses have been introduced by many people like Malcolm Levitt, Tycho, and several others, Jonathan Jones in quantum computation, Wimperis, with the goal of compensating for errors due to imperfections, systematic imperfections in the controllers. It could be off-axis errors, it could be over-rotation. So basically, you know, or you assume the functional form of what type of the error you have, but not quantitatively how much the error would be. That's the beauty of the composite pulses, I think, that you know qualitatively the form, but not the strength. And by exploiting how different rotation compose non-linearly, if they are cascade one after the other, you come up with a more complicated composite rotation whose total error is less than the error of each individual building blocks. Now, I have called this kind of error classical because they arise from imperfection in or improper tuning of the parameters in our controller. What I would like to do is instead to fix errors which come from my quantum mechanical environment, the coherence errors. So another idea that the MMR community has brought along is, well, we can have this, for instance, was used in the context of NMR QIP by Corey's group a lot, is like strongly modulating pulses where the error Hamiltonian is due to unwanted coupling between other spins while you are trying to rotate some other spins. So for instance, having two spins, you are trying to perform a pi or pi over two rotation on spin one. It takes finite time, it's selective, and you have to compensate for J couplings or other effects during that. So in this case, the error Hamiltonian is fully known. It is quantum mechanical, and the idea is to strongly modulate the one spin you are trying to control so that effectively you remove the unwanted evolution by trying to steer the second the spin, the target spin, in the direction you want as well. So I want to put together these two principles because the dynamically corrected gates I am aiming to, they are going to be composite. So I'm going to package them. A lot of gates, which I'm going to call primitive gates, which are subject to decoherence. So composite is going to be one of the ingredients. But I want to give myself the possibility to quantitatively know the decoherence or the environment that goes on. I want to be able to achieve the gate design by assuming as little knowledge as possible about the Bath operator and the Bath Hamiltonian. So if you like, you can view this as a robust control theory problem because the Hamiltonian of the environment, they define the uncertainty or the model uncertainty into your Hamiltonian engineering problem. So how to do that? So is the task clear? I want to design gates which are robust, which suppress decoherence during the gating time. I will do so by packaging available primitive gates which do suffer of decoherence with the hope that the fatter gate I am coming up at the end will have less total decoherence than each of those. And I will want to do so without giving myself complete knowledge of the decoherence I'm trying to remove. Just the symmetry properties, just the fact that it will have to have a finite strength. That is the setting. The assumption I just told you in words, mathematically, they can be summarized like this. System Hamiltonian, I'm going to consider specifically now the case of a quantum register because we are going to do gates. So each qubit is coupled to a Bath operator. Bath operator, this is bounded but unknown. And also the Bath Hamiltonian is bounded but unknown. The assumption that I will do for this, for the purposes on these talks, what are my primitive capabilities here? this strategy is meant to say, suppose that you can have available certain primitive operation, maybe certain set of universal gates that you can perform on your system, but with too much error. So these are the ones that I'm going to assume my primitive gates here are going to be arbitrary single qubit operation, and I have picked an Ising coupling. This set is universal. So my premise is that I can implement this, but I want to come up with a way to implement them with a smaller error per gate. Okay, and I will do that. I said no bang bang anymore, so I will work from now on within the setting of having a finite amplitude for each and every of the control functions here. And I will also impose a constraint on the minimum gating time that I will give myself, because these two are related. But if you want, this is the time domain, and having a minimum switching times mean that your Fourier spectrum is going to be bounded as well. So the structure of a dynamically corrected gate will look like, as I said, it's a fat gate. It is composed of n primitive blocks, and I need a measure for computing the error per gate. And what I am computing, oops, this should be here. I like to see each unitary evolution that goes on the system and above as the product of the ideal one I would like to accomplish times an error. And that is what I'm going to use as an error action. So for each of the blocks here, I will have the desired action here, which is due to the control, times the rest. Whatever the rest is, it can always be cast, because it's a unitary operator, in terms of I and then an Hermitian operator, which is the error action. Action because I'm looking at a time, so it's a Hamiltonian times a time, physically speaking. So that's why action. And this is an expression that you can get. So these are computable things if you know, of course, that the sequence of control operation you are going to do. So this is something that I'm going to use for computing the error per gate. And in this language, my task is, we said that we start with each of these blocks having an error which is proportional to how long the gate is and how strong the error is. Yes. I want to, first of all, to first order, manage to construct this block in such a way that I go from a linear scaling to a quadratic scaling in this. That's the task I want to achieve. Gavin, yes?
So is this error term, this is unitary in the space of the qubit?
No, this is system buff.
Oh, so it's unitary
yes,
the entire
yes,
space.
Yes. The trace over the environment in all of these things will only happen at the very end.
And there could be leakage, for instance.
Oh, yeah. It can be anything unwanted that the coupling between the system and the buff generates, except it is always possible to do this separation just by moving to the toggling frame of the control. I haven't said that, but given the question, that's the way you go to the interaction picture of the control, and therefore you can separate exactly the control action from whatever else. And this control action, ideally, it should be only on the system tensor, an evolution on the bar. But this is system bar throughout.
I didn't follow this. That didn't import. So, how did you? You said that if you go into an interaction representation, you can always write the evolution operator in that way.
Yes.
I don't
whenever you go to an so if you have a sum of two Hamiltonians, H1 plus H2, if you go to the interaction frame with respect to H2 and you look at the Hamiltonian equation of motion in the new frame, in the interaction picture, explicitly the H2 disappears, but it appears indirectly because the new Hamiltonian will be modulated by the transformation that you have affected. It's the usual interaction picture.
I don't see immediately why you get that form of the...
This?
No, the one about this? Control times.
Because this is in the Schrödinger picture, and this would be the propagator in the analog of the interaction picture, but I have to I have to do the transformation. So this is the interaction picture propagator, and that's the physical.
Oh, okay, so phi isn't just a phase factor.
No. Phi is an operator.
Okay.
Because this whole thing is unitary, it can always be viewed as I times an Hermitian operator, which is here. And the first task is to be sure that it gets reduced with a quadratic scaling, because in that way we will have gained one order of magnitude, one order in the decoherence suppression. Okay, how to do that? So I have divided this up in two steps, because it seems like many times when we try to do control, we have to first be able to do nothing, and then we have to be able to do arbitrary gates. So the first step here is to revisit how to get a fat gate with errors, as I said, where the target transformation I want to achieve is nothing, is the identity. So what I want to do is to seek a combination of my primitive blocks so that at the end of the day, I will have done an identity on my system. That's what we call the knot in quantum information. And I will have done that with a total smaller error than just leaving the system alone. The NOAP is a special gate. Then I will want to do a generic gate. And in fact, the recipe for this is something that I mentioned, and I wasn't aware of this, that it was already solved. I already solved this problem years ago, but I didn't recognize it until recently.
Does that problem even exist? Don't you just intersperse it with unit operators and get back your decoupling sequence? If it's an identity gate, then
what do you mean? I don't have instantaneous pulses to intersperse with. I'm missing the question, probably.
I mean, assuming you've got the decoupling sequence, which keeps your system steady.
No, that's the one I want. I mean, what do you mean by a decoupling sequence again?
Well, you've just described a procedure which removes the adherence to a screen.
But that was under the assumption of having unbounded control.
Okay,
I don't have that, yeah. I don't want to have anything to do with that anymore. So I'm asking the same question. I want to suppress the coherence, but I don't have the possibilities of doing instantaneous passes. So I don't have a decoupling sequence in that sense, but I do have it in the sense of one recipe I was mentioning briefly in the tutorial is to do Euler decoupling. And let me just revisit this in the example that we need. We don't need a general procedure, but what we need, I have a quantum register consisting of qubits, and the most general error model for qubits can be viewed as each qubit is undergoing linear decoherence with either independent reservoirs or collective reservoir, but in point of fact, the decoupling loop that we can have consists of four operations, which now I am viewing in terms of having two primitive Hamiltonians that I can affect. So now I'm going to imagine that I can turn on and off a collective qubit Hamiltonians, which have this form, some over the xi's and some over the yi. These are going to be generators for all the control actions I can do. And I won't give you the proof of why this is the case. The proofs are in there. But if we turn on and off this Hamiltonian according to what turns out to be a cycle of this form, this is a sequence of eight operations, each of which has a finite duration tau. So you can view it as a cascade of eight square pulses, if you like, but none of them is instantaneous anymore. And you can prove that in the end of the day, what the net effect of this control procedure is that you get no operation on the system, with an error that you can compute mathematically, and this second order with respect to the switching times, to the durations of the gate. So if you would just leave the qubit evolve alone, we said before that it would pick up error proportional, linearly proportional to tau and the error strength. If you instead apply Hamiltonians in that path, in the end of the day, after 8 delta t's, every initial state of the qubit is preserved. That's what it means having an OOP gate, that whatever state you put in, you get it back. But the error with which this happens is no longer linear in tau, but it has become quadratic. So if tau is small, the whole game here is to be in a regime where the taus are already sufficiently small, so they're going from linear to quadratic to cubic, whatever, you gain.
Your control propagator doesn't have any less terms.
My control propagator?
XO.
Yes.
It's exponential, so it's some time ordering, some weights, and then your control operators.
These are the control input, and this means I am doing a collective rotation on all the spins.
That's right.
In a finite time.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's my point.
Yes.
I mean, if you're doing an operation on spins in finite time, you must have fast terms in the propagator because they're coupled to that.
Yes. Yes. Of course, but this is just the ideal control operation that I am. This is the general. But when I compute the error going along here, the bath is there. It's hidden in these phis. These phis are this error action where the bath is there. Yes, of course.
Actually,
yes.
Appears somehow.
Yes.
Actually, just to mention, that's the well-known XY8 cycle. It's known
1960s. I would love to do this, because as far as I can tell,
there's also further expansions, XY6, XY32, and so on, that even as opposed to further suppress the
right. Because in the context, I always ask myself from this year, how is Euler decoupling related to NMR? The one example I found is the alternating pair of pulses for suppressing the Z noise in Eberlein. That is a super cycle which is Euler. But yeah. I'm not claiming, but let's go.
Just to mention that.
I would want to have the reference because I always like to point that out. Okay, that's the second step. And now I want to do the same, so canceling, making error from first order to second order, but not wanting to have a no-op, so preservation. I want now that every input state of the qubit will undergo a gate of my choice. Pi over 2 gate or whatever. Okay. So I want to seek a combination of primitive gates that still suppresses the decoherence but achieves a net rotation at the end. And it turns out that this is more challenging. In order to achieve the no-op gate before, I did not need to make any specific assumption on I said that each primitive gate has errors, but I didn't say anything else. I didn't need to make any assumption on what these primitive errors would be. Turns out that if you want to do a non-trivial gate, you have to assume something more. And of course, I cannot assume to know the error of the primitive gates because I said that I do not want to assume knowledge about the bath. I don't have that knowledge. But still, even if I don't have that knowledge, knowing the control, I can still hope to find some combinations of primitive gates of which I don't know what error they have, but maybe they happen to have the same error. That much I can hope. Even not knowing the error that each of them will have, I can still try to match it. Okay, turns out that's the key ingredient. We call this a balanced pair of gates. And what I mean is, suppose that you manage to find a way for implementing a special no-op gate, and you, the operation you want to perform, in terms of sequences which have an unknown error, but the same. See, I have written down phi and phi. I don't know phi, but I'm just requesting, suppose it is the same. And I will tell you in the next slide how to make sure that it's going to be the same. But suppose that is the case, then what you see here is modified without these strange arms. This was the same graph that I had before. So each of these arms is meant to be a delay time that implements a little knot with that error. So suppose for 1 second that you put, not this here, but you put all rounded arms here. What that would mean is that you have modified your path in such a way that it will still do nothing as before. You would just have made it longer. But now, we have assumed that U has the same error as I. So take one of these rounded edges and make it into another vertex, which does the gate you want. The net effect, if you follow this modified path, is that it no longer does nothing. It does the final gate that you want to achieve. And mathematically, it keeps the cancellation properties that you wanted to have. That is, the error per gate scales to second order in the errors of each primitive block. You will say this is black magic, how to ensure that errors will be the same even though you don't know it. It's actually simpler than you might think. And one way to ensure, now I'm going to simplify. So far I haven't told what my control profile are going to be. Let me make them square pulses. These are the simplest possible I can consider. If I do so, a very easy recipe for making sure that I come up with a sequence of 2 primitive gates, one of which does nothing, and the other does a gate that I want, is in one case to use a symmetric profile, and in the other case, an anti-symmetric profile. So you can compute what I call the error action for these profiles here, and you will see that so this one and this one gives you not the same expression, but the same expression to the leading order in tau in the duration that I want. So what that means is that putting all the things together, and I will show you results and will be done, is that if you want to do a dynamically corrected gate on a single, in the presence of arbitrary linear decoherence in a quantum register, what it takes is, in this construction, 16 time slots. We had 8 to just do nothing, but then by adding these curly arms and these modifications of the path, we pick up an overhead which is the same. It is much better if you only have pure dephasing, because in that case you have 6 time slots.
Is your accuracy, is your error suppression accuracy linear, polynomial, or exponential in the number of gates that you have, in the number of operations?
This depends on the error model. In this case, this is what you get. Is from 1 you go to 16. It is, I can give you you wanted to know linear, polynomial, in?
Or exponential, in the number of operations you've got to put in the number of individual controls.
To this first order, this is a very good question. To this first order, it's just polynomial. Because for this error model, I have to specify an error model. I'm saying that I have arbitrary linear decoherence for each qubit, and I go...
So that's a very serious question. What's the potential of killing the entire concept of quantum computation if your accuracy grows exponentially?
No, it's not the accuracy. It doesn't kill quantum computation. What it kills is the possibility to use to do quantum computation purely using this open loop techniques. Which is a very good question, because the exponential issue comes up when I want to do suppression to higher order, which is the very last slide. At this level, for the arbitrary single qubit error model, which is the predominant in quantum computation, this is as bad as it gets, without optimizing without optimizing. This is just the worst case. You get 16 time slots for each gate you want to make. That's it. It's a fixed number to first order.
So it's only mean by linear decoherence.
Linear decoherence means that suppose each spin is each qubit is going to be a spin. It couples arbitrarily to an environment via sigma x, sigma y, sigma z for all of the qubits. Okay, these are examples. I think it's better to look at illustrative situations, because what we wanted to see, going back to the picture I had in the very first thing, is like, suppose we run a little algorithm with physical gates which have a certain error. Suppose I replace each of these gates with the dynamically corrected gates that I just constructed. How much do I gain? Okay. This is exact numerical simulation, so it's a tiny bath that we have considered. So we have considered creating a 3-qubit cut state benchmark, something like this. So that's the circuit that you would implement with the wrong gates first and then with the dynamically error-corrected gates. The error Hamiltonian is this one, so what I mean by error Hamiltonian, again, is it's the one that induces the decoherence on our 3-qubit register. And you see, linear decoherence, Vlad, this is a concrete example. Each of the three spin in the system are coupled via this to the reservoir, to the nuclear spin, if you like, bath. And the bath itself has a kind of a dipolar evolution ruled by certain coefficients. So overhead, in this case, the DCG implementation, the dynamically corrected, in this case, what you have is like an Hadamard and two control knots. The control knots are written in terms of single qubit and Ising, because the Ising was my choice. It doesn't have to, but I started with that. And then each of these is implemented with a 16 FAT gate. Okay, so you have 256 primitive operations that enter in the calculation of this. So I like to show the results in this form. This is an axis where you have the infidelity for the uncorrected algorithm, what you would get with the original gates. And this axis is instead what you would get by replacing each of the operations with a corrected one. It's a log-log scale, but still, if we look at the bisector here, it would mean that we would have no improvement. And you see another line here, which is giving us a cone. Everywhere in between, it's a parameter region where you gain, you reduce the error. What does it mean concretely? Suppose that I choose my primitive error rate to be order of 1%. So that means that without doing the error correction in this particular case, I would end up having a fidelity of 99%. Not bad, but suppose we want to do even better, because these gates are supposed to go in the high fidelity regime. So if I, at this operating error level, if I do the algorithm with the error corrected gates, you see that the intersection now goes down here, and you have gained that much. That's what it means in practice. So the EPG corrected gains goes quadratically, because this goes linear, and that's as much as you gain here. Now you might be curious, how stable is this in the presence of additional faults? My rotation so far, I had decoherence, but I assumed that my controller was not having other errors. So what if we also have those errors, like for instance, here we have pulse length error in place. That's the same way of showing results. That's the same two lines that I was having. And now what you see is that how good or how much you can gain also depends on the obviously on the level of systematic or control error that you have. So for instance, I was at 1% before. That was with here. Now suppose I was picking up this curve, which corresponds to a systematic error level of 1% also. Okay, so now you have both the coherence and classical errors, both on the 1% level, and the curve is like this. That means that you still have an improvement, but eventually the systematic error, which is not going to be completely compensated, but this is going to dominate, and in the moment it dominates, the performance is no longer improving. You cannot take out more this scheme as it is designed to correct for decoherence, not for decoherence together with control error, although you could combine with the usual composite pulses and hope to get, I wouldn't go this way, it's better to optimize at that point in additional ways, but this makes a lot of sense because once the uncompensated errors that you have dominates over the one that you are not that you have designed to correct for, then your procedure stops giving you an improvement. And I think we can just spend a few minutes more. It's much done. I would like to pick up on Ilya's question because he was asking about overheads. And let me just say what I'm doing these days, literally, is to ask, okay, we have suppressed the coherence as first order. We have done it with a reasonable effort. It might still be useful in practical implementation as it is, but how far can we push this? Can, in principle, the suppression of decoherence during the gate be pushed to as arbitrary orders, not just from linear to quadratic, but linear to, I don't know, the 10th power? Is it possible in principle, and what resources is it going to entail? So this question has an answer, and the answer is yes, it can be done. And it can be done in principle, again, by using a recursive construction whereby you can embed. We have the first order. We can embed them and use as building block for dynamically corrected gates, which are compensated to second order, and keep going. It's not as simple as I'm trying to make it sound, because you have to match errors along the way, but it is possible to do, and we have a fully analytical and constructive procedure for do so. It does not aim to be optimal at all. The construction we get is badly inefficient with respect to the number of blocks that are needed if you want to go in higher order. And this is just an example. This is now one qubit with a reservoir. And we were just finishing, I'm not even sure these are going to be final data, but this is a single qubit rotation. This is the primitive gate. And then first order, that's the one I showed you just before, second order, third order. And if you can read, you know, here is like 20 times the tau mean. So that's the length of the overall sequence. It goes up. And I can tell you it goes up exponentially in the absence of any other optimization. Now, you can say that's killing there.
That certainly is a strong candidate for killing it.
However, it is not optimized. So this is just an existential argument that shows that, in principle, you see, when you are suppressing the coherence to higher and higher order, you have a tree of commutators that you have to cancel or suppress. So it was not obvious to me that second order is easy because you have the time symmetrization trick, but it's not automatically going beyond. So the very fact that it can be done in principle tells me that this purely quantum mechanical commutator tree structure does not pose a fundamental problem. Practically, it's a different story. And practically, however, I don't know, this tau mean is kind of a digitization size. So you might view, you might say, okay, having 2,000 little primitive gates is impossible, it's exponentially efficient. But what if you look at them as being a digitized pulse profile? Yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, we had one which had 40,000 parameters or something. I mean, the complexity still of this gate is nothing compared to the pulse profile that GRAPES or optimal control theory is giving as output. It just looks like overwhelming because you have a way to count and to assess the overhead. But I leave it like this. I'm not thinking that this is the practical way to go. I think this lays the theoretical foundations to say that you can, in principle, arbitrarily suppress the coherence during gates, and in the same way as all the classical composite sequences have been recovered, and I might say practically superseded by more powerful, better designed, numerically designed sequences, perhaps I would like to hope that the same is going to happen here. And with that, I think I'll put up conclusions. And I already extensively made this point here. Other experimental implementation, in case you are curious about decoupling, they are in the tutorial. One of them has been even highlighted in the June issue of Physics Today, the one by Birsek and company in Trapion. And about DCGs and concatenated DCGs, I would also hope that the first order can be used as they are within device technologies. And for the higher order, I think it's really a good moment for merging and see how the optimization can help. Thank you.
I was curious in your performance plot for the CAD-state preparation.
Without the control errors?
Yeah, without controllers.
So this one.
Yeah, right. So what was the pulse shape you used?
Rectangular, because these are analytically exact simulation. You don't have to do rectangular. It could be Gaussian, it could be whatever you choose.
And it looks reasonably the same.
We haven't done it. Because if you give me an arbitrary pulse shape, I have to go back and find the constructive recipe for matching the finding the two primitive sequences with the same error gain. I don't expect that this is sensitively dependent upon which pulse profile you choose in the elementary, in the primitive gate. But do you have reason to think?
Well, phase shifts, sort of one of those, where you have it, looks like an anti-symmetric.
Oh, right. It is an anti-symmetric. That is needed because this is one that goes, you know, this is going to be a delay time that I insert here. And I need it to be anti-symmetric because this is kind of doing a little gate and it's inverse. But you don't have to do with the square profile. You can do it in other ways. I don't know how much it will impact the performance, but I don't expect much at all.
Your primitive gates are error-free? Primitive creation?
No. In this simulation, the primitive gates, they do not suffer, again, in this simulation, there is no pulse length error, no offset, no systematic control error. But the primitive gate suffers of decoherence error. When you do each primitive gate, you pick up a decoherence error because the gate has a finite time and the decoherence happens during that time. If decoherence and control errors, for instance, pulse length error, so your profile is miscalibrated, you see, it's like instead of having this, you have this plus something, then you have both in place.
Another question I have, when you compose many pulses, so how do you connect, let's say, pulses in between to each other. So in terms of simulation, so usually if you have a pulse interaction with your qubits, so I assume that you have to do full evolution during all your pulses and then take average there, right?
Average of what?
Rates over the pulse. So you calculate the evolution of your qubit during all your pulses.
You mean in the simulation, how it is computed here? Well, we have a circle. So I have three qubits. I have to propagate three qubits plus, in this simulation, five Bach spin. And I propagate them exactly under, well, according what the circuit tells me. The first operation is an Hadamard, but the Hadamard would be translated into 16 elementary gates. So the first part of the simulation does that. And then right after, you subject the same 3 plus 5 spins to what the translation of the C0 gate tells you.
Yeah, it says my question is, so you have to trace at the end by pass, right?
Oh, yeah.
So you are doing it at the end of your simulation, or you are doing after each pulse? How you treat? You understand what I mean?
Yeah. I do it at the end here. But not even sure that I understand it right. Of course, the bath is always there. So you would like it not to be there, but it's there. So in reality, what you as experimentalists will do is to turn on and off Hamiltonians according to a certain rule. The bath will be there. It will be there for you. So.
Yeah,
and in the simulation, it's going to be the same. I have the bath evolving, and I'm designing the control.
Yeah, I understand. No, I mean, there's no problem. Curious. So
yeah.
When you do bend-bend control.
But there is no bend-bend here.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So it seems to me, if you sort of like remove the requirement for bend-bend control, instantaneous pulses, the same kind of technique, the same kind of results, are still waiting. So when, yeah, you understand what I mean, right?
No.
So in a sense, all your pulses are here the same. So you have sequence of the pulses will give you control over the interference.
Yes.
Before you was doing this interference control by using the instantaneous pulses.
No, but careful. Before I was only achieving nothing at the end. I was just memorizing the state.
No, just remove the gates. Forget about gates. So you just control the interference by using the non-delta power.
Yes, power. Then I do the
so in a sense, the same, right? The same results achieved. The coherence control.
Yes. And my naive way was to do the Euler, and then Burkhardt is telling me that the generalizations exist to higher order. So yes, we can do it.
No, it seems to me at this point, I would say there is you can control decoherence by any means, using the delta function pulses or just normal pulses, and it should not be a problem. So that's why I'm kind of. And before I had this impression that you need these strong delta pulses to control the coherence.
No. The whole point, yes, that might be worth.
You're telling me that you don't need it. That's why.
No, in fact, I mean, the delta pulses is a very convenient starting point for getting there. But I mean, the very fact that I don't need this is I mean, they don't exist in nature. The experimentalists, they don't have them. What they have is a good approximation, very narrow pulses at the best. But certainly part of what I was trying to convince you is like, yes, it is true. You don't need the bang-bang pulses. You can do the same, but you have to be much more sophisticated in designing the control, just like the algorithms that you have to run in the presence of constraints. They presumably are more elaborated than the ones which are free to run without no constraints at all. Does it make sense? Yeah, that it's not needed to be Bang-Bang to use dynamical quantum error correction. Not at all. Yeah, Gavin.
Have you thought about using dynamical decoupling in the context of quantum simulations?
Oh, yeah.
You're an engineer. Hamiltonian.
For Hamiltonian simulation.
Screw up the engineering a little bit and using dynamical decoupling to remove the unwanted engineered terms.
Well, Hamiltonian simulation has been studied quite a bit by people like Martin Roetteler, Pavel Votsian, and also the computer science community who came up with the combinatorial decoupling schemes and merging those with Euler, Eulerian orthogonal arrays. So I haven't emphasized that part much. But if you're thinking to, are you thinking to embed the gates into a simulation algorithm?
No, I'm thinking not that. Not a physical type simulation, but an analog one where you're not trying to make a fault tolerance simulation.
Okay, okay.
That's something where you engineer an always on Hamiltonian, which is not correct. There's some problems with the design, and you want to remove those design errors by dynamical.
I don't see a fundamental obstacle to that at all. Yes, I mean, maybe we should talk about it. Yes. Yeah, you can also view it because one thing that in this spirit you might be interested in knowing is like if you start doing these control sequences and you look in higher and higher order, you are renormalizing the whole evolution. So you are creating effective longer range couplings which were not there in lowest orders. So it has something to do with gadgets, but I don't know if, this connection is, I didn't have the time to think about it.
Okay.
Thank you.
So let's, before people disperse,